Yeah, and also some companies are starting to make the salary, at least the bandwidth, transparent, right? So there's more access to actual data on how much people are getting paid. And so I think it's also shifting in that direction. And you have Glassdoor, you have other platforms where you can actually see how much other people are making.
Yeah. So this was about, let's say, the pay gaps. Mm-hmm. What about the working setups?
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, we were of the survey, we asked people for some information on how they work currently. So what we saw is that that only 2% of the PMs who participated in the survey work in the office, right? So fully in the office. So 30% work fully remote, which is quite a lot, I think, and 67% in a hybrid setup. Yeah. That was, it's not super surprising, but actually seeing the numbers makes you realize like this is the new normal, right? So if you're a company, you're trying to get people into the office 5 days a week, you're going to have a hard time finding candidates who want to do that.
Did it mean from your salary benchmark perspective that you have to pay these people more if you want to push them to the office 5 days a week, or no correlated?
I did not look into this correlation, but it's super interesting. We should do that, actually. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I can tell you. I could imagine from the eyes of the employer, if you really want to push people into the office, you know, what are you getting? Because mm-hmm. I just said the offer is still very scattered. So I imagine, mm-hmm. I just say for me, the normality is that people want to work hybrid, if not remote, mm-hmm. today. So it would be extremely interesting to know from an employer perspective, yeah. if you really need to get people locally, what it would mean for you. And also, I would expect you've got less reach. Mm-hmm. you can't go and
pick
people far.
Yeah, and you're now competing with companies who are not even in your country, right, yeah. as an employer, because some people are sitting in Portugal and working for Swiss companies, right, fully remote. And so interesting.
Sorry. Did this create anything like more homogeneous, you know, especially both of us, we were sitting in Switzerland, but we used to get a market which is pretty much a bubble. Mm-hmm. Did you also see Europe, at least in general, becoming more homogeneous in terms of salaries because of remote working?
I can only tell you that there's definitely still a pay gap, for example, between Germany and Switzerland. I have not looked into like all of the European countries in a specific comparison, because some of the countries have so little data sets in our sample that it does not make so much sense, especially if you start slicing for roles, right? But it would be interesting to see. I can tell you definitely for Germany and Switzerland, there is a pay gap. And just to make that clear, we normalized for a 40-hour work week. Because you know that Switzerland usually work 42 hours, which is already a difference. So that's why another thing that we paid attention to in this survey is how many hours do people actually work? And if you said you work part-time, then we normalized it for a 40-hour week too, so that we can really compare it.
That's a very good point. And you were mentioning at the beginning, right, that this working condition in general, like how many hours you like to work and so on, were also part of your survey.
Yeah. That was interesting too. So what we saw is like 90% of all the people in the survey work full time. And full time in most cases means overtime too, right? We'll talk about that in a sec. But 90% by contract, they work full time. Of the remaining 10%, most of them work 90% or 80%. And just a very, very small fraction is below 80%. So part time in product below 80% is still basically non-existing.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. What is your reading into this?
I think there is a general notion that the product role can only be done full time. And you were asking for controversial opinions. I'm a big believer in part time. I also work part time. And of course, my job is a bit different in this case. But I believe that in the right setup, with the right surrounding roles in place, with the right kind of ownership in place in the engineering teams and so on, it would be possible in certain industries, in certain contexts, for the PMs to work less than 80% or to do job sharing between two PMs. And I think that would unlock a lot of female potential in the market, because I see a lot of people dropping out when they have kids and then having a hard time to come back to their positions because they're no longer willing or able to work full time.
No, I completely with you. And because you're mentioning controversial topics, I would go even further. I would say working above 100% from my perspective is a red flag of something going wrong. Either there is something wrong in the way you're defining the job, or there is something wrong in the way you're executing your job, I guess. But it potentially may be an indicator you're not able to delegate or to give enough guidance to people, so you're not in this, you know, you're not unavoidable anymore.
Where the expectations that are set for your role, and we talked about this before, are not realistic. And I generally agree, but I also have to say that I am a believer in the cyclic nature of humans, and also in the cyclic nature of businesses. So where I see a red flag is if it continuously is above 100%. I do believe that it might make sense and can happen that you have to work more than 100% in certain circumstances, but then you need to have time to bounce back into relaxation, into a different pace, right? And if you don't see that happening, then it's not healthy. Right? And I can even give you the numbers if you're interested. So what I saw in the survey is that 76% of PMs are not compensated for their overtime. 21% of the people who took the survey can take time off and compensate with time off, and the rest is either compensated financially, so that's a very small part, or does not know. Could not answer for some reason, right? So, I mean, most people, you have to also add that to your, when you look at salaries, for example, in the US, they tend to be higher, right? We saw that in the survey too. But in the US, they work 19% overtime on average, according to our survey, right? So you have to also take that into consideration when you're comparing the salaries, plus the job insecurity and all of that that comes with the system they have in place there, right? And here we saw that in general, there's an average overtime of 7 to 9% for PMs and POs on average. And we saw that in general, that overtime is higher once you get into leadership positions or higher positions of individual contributors like principal. Actually, the product principals were the ones working the most. They had 19% overtime on average, right? And then, of course, for the higher leadership positions, we also saw quite high numbers, yeah.
That's funny, but the more you speak about this topic, the more I'm realizing that when somebody asks you what is the salary you should make, which is the average question we get, that would give you like 10% of the answer. Would give you really a small fraction of the truth, because the problem is not where you're making 100, 150, 200. The problem is much wider.
At the beginning, I wanted to calculate the hourly wage, because I think that would be the actual number we should be comparing, like compared to the amount of hours that you're supposed to work, or you have to really work in this job, how much are you making?
And without talking about, you know, how interesting is your job, what is this non-material, non-measurable, because you might be earning a little bit less, but being very happy. You're talking about happiness before.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also asked them about like what other perks do you get or do you value about your compensation? As I said, compensation is not just the salary and the bonus, right? And we saw that, for example, since we have a lot of people from the US also in the survey, subsidized or paid medical insurance was very high on the list, because that's not a given in many countries, right? Training budget, 22% said they want to have training budget, or they have training budget that they value. But then there was a lot of other things like flexible working hours, having a gym available or subsidized, subsidized public transportation. Then some people get special discounts from their brands that they work for, but also vacations, extra holidays. Some people have unlimited holidays. It was like 2.5%, I think, in the survey who do have unlimited holidays. We saw that those people mentioned that very explicitly in the survey,
because like a perk.
Seem to be very happy about it, right? Yeah, so there's a lot of other things. You can see the full list in the report again, but there's other things that people value a lot besides just the compensation.
The word is complex. In reality, you cannot summarize with a number, and that's probably also for people starting in the profession or even trying to evolve in the profession. You can't just look at a number and say, what is the right number for me, right?
Exactly, and you also need to know what does success look like to me? Is it, for example, I want to accelerate my career in terms of titles, then you need to look for certain things in a company, like what are my chances to get promoted? What are they looking for in the next levels of product leadership? But it could also be like, I want to learn specific things. I want to get better at my craft. And then I'm looking maybe for mentorship. I'm looking for very experienced people that I can learn from. I'm looking for training opportunities and so on, right? So it really depends on where you want to go. And as I said in the beginning, knowing what you want is one of the hardest things. But once you know it, you can also look for it more specifically. And that's why one of the advices that I give to people in our classes is to have a learning backlog for themselves, because this is also what will tell you when it's time to leave a company. Mm. For me, that's when the learning curve flattens and when you're no longer getting closer to your goals there.
I would be interesting about your experience, because you've got this exceptional view on a part of the population today, with this PM population. So you mentioned about this learning becoming flat, this learning curve becoming flat. The general perception out is that people stay less and less in their job, and they jump a little bit more than they used to do, probably our parents or even just 10 or 20 years mm-hmm. ago. It is something you're also observing in the reality of your classes, people jumping more from one job to the other?
It's a bit hard to generalize. I've seen people who are very happy at the companies that they are at, and where the companies do a great job at nurturing the relationship with these employees. And I, without having data to back this up, my gut feeling is that it often depends on charismatic and very skilled product leaders who are able to nurture the potential of the next generation of product people, finding ways for them to grow even when they don't have a promotion. Sometimes they're able to keep them for a very long time, while other companies lose their employees very fast because they want to have a certain title, right? So it doesn't necessarily just correlate with the titles that you're looking for. I think a leader can compensate for some of that for quite a long time, as long as you're learning from this person and making an impact, I think. But I see a certain tendency to jump around in the market and that can have two reasons, right? One is you understand more and more what kind of product person you want to be and what the kind of product work looks like that you want to do. And I see that a lot when people come into our classes and they realize for the first time, man, what I've been doing in the past couple of years, that's nowhere near the kind of product work that I could be doing and that I want to do actually. So then suddenly they realize, okay, I might want to look for something elsewhere, right? That's one reason. That's not a bad reason, right? And then sometimes I also notice a lack of resilience in younger generations, maybe, of product people, like shying away from the first couple of conflicts that they're facing and feeling entitled to a better place somewhere else. But I think, there's a certain type of conversations, hard conversations that you need to be able to endure. Those are the right kind of hard. And then there's a couple of hard situations and conversations that take away your energy on a constant basis and that don't fuel your learning curve and don't fuel your growth as a person. And if you're stuck in these kind of situations, then leaving is a good thing, right? So I'm trying to kind of make people more aware of what is the right kind of hard, because product management is hard. It's supposed to be hard, but sometimes we're making it hard for the wrong reasons.
Totally. And I'm taking away also between the line of what you're saying is that to some extent, so a good leader could compensate, you meant, for less ideal situation. Probably you could read it also the other way around. Money can compensate for a bad leader, which is not good, right? So potentially and it happens, right? So probably you can read the other way around and saying having a good salary might be covering or just sugarcoating a situation which is not ideal.
It's like a golden cage, right? Because then you have a very high salary, maybe a comfortable setup with not having to work too much overtime. So your hourly wage is pretty high, actually. And you start building your lifestyle around it. And then it's getting harder and harder to go away, right? To step away from this kind of situation. But we see people doing that because we saw, we also asked the question, like, how does your salary change within the company and also in between jobs when you apply for a different company? And what we saw is like within the same company, on average, people were able to get an 8% raise. However, I have to say, like, we did not specifically ask for it within which time frame. I know that some people have been in the same company for a long time and they have also taken on more responsibility. So over time, they have on average managed to get 8% raise within the same company. Once they were changing jobs, the average raise was around 30%. So the big jumps is that those you make when you change the company and you renegotiate your entire setup, often because you also maybe apply for a different level of maturity in the roles, right? And so that also makes up for some of the difference. But what we also saw is that some people took a demotion in terms of salary, right? And on average, those who earned less after changing roles, they earned like 17% less. And the reasons they gave was mostly because they wanted to move into a product role and they were willing to maybe start with a junior position or with a lower pay just to do some more meaningful work. And some also wanted to move into startups and got some equity maybe on the side. So that made up for some of the salary change that they had.
And you're opening exactly the last question I got about compensation, which is equity, probably not the easiest part of the question, right?
Yeah. So I was surprised to see that 37% of the people in our survey mentioned they get equity. However, we have to say that 50% of the entire sample size are people working in startup or scale-ups. So like, can just to put that into perspective, 50% working in startups and scale-ups, 37% getting equity, right? Most of them will probably be the ones working in startups and scale-ups because most enterprises do not give out stock options for their employees. Some do, but not all. What was interesting, it was, I think 1.6% of the participants in the survey said they did not know whether they had equity or not, which is quite interesting, right? And many mentioned in the free text form, we don't know how much our equity is worth. I know I have some sort of stock options, but I have no clue whether they're worth something. Wow. And that's why we also started looking into this topic and said, like, okay, there's a knowledge gap here for many people who don't know how stock works in general. And Marina Moric was so nice to write a really, really wonderful article about what stock and equity means in the context of a product role. We can maybe add it to the show notes or link it somewhere. Okay, yeah. Because it was really nice how she explained it in a very easy way for people to understand. And it's a complex topic. It has a lot of tax implications and so on. So whenever you're offered stock, it's wise to maybe ask people who know a thing or two about it to understand what it's really worth.
Yeah. That's exactly why I was asking, because I find this astonishing. So on one hand, what you're saying, tell me if the numbers are right, but 30% of people don't know whether they got stocks or not, right?
So no, actually 37% get equity and know it, and about 1.6% don't know. Close to 2% don't know whether they get stock.
And these people who don't know, so that means it means something, right? You don't even know how you're compensated. And among people who are getting the stocks, people don't know how much they're making. So there is one volatile part, which is normal. You don't know how much they're worth. It's part of the stocks. You don't know how much they're going to be worth the day you want to exercise them. That's normal. But people not being able to appreciate that means that to some extent it fails as a tool, right? To motivate people if people don't even understand.
That, and also I think people either over or underestimate what it means to have stock, right? So they either overestimate it because they have no clue that they, for example, are owning stock classes who are going to be served last when there is an exit, right? So they don't know what LIC preferences are and so on. So that is something that happened to me too in my first startup, right? I didn't know a thing about this and nobody told me because they were better off not telling me. So I think we need to do some education around these things. That's why we have this wonderful article now. And some people maybe underestimate it because they feel like, I don't know anything about it, but also like, probably doesn't mean anything to have stock, right? So they, I think looking into this would be interesting for most people who do have equity and maybe talk about, because it also tells you something about the strategy that the company is pursuing, right? Who are my investors? What are they trying to achieve, right? So it's really good, not just from the compensation perspective, what are my chances of getting paid or not, but also like, what is this company doing? How is it valued from the outside? Why is it is the valuation going up or down?
Absolutely. And I was mentioning this because this goes back to the very first topic we were discussing before about empowerment. Now, how can you be empowered and looking beyond your nose and understanding whether what you're doing or not is good for your company if you eventually don't understand what your company is doing, how its shareholder base is composed, what matters to them, and so on and so forth. And I think what is nice, in my opinion, about equity compensation is it forces you to be in the same boat with some difference, again, because there are classes and some books, but pretty much in the same boat and having to understand those topics, which are the first topics you need to understand anyway if you want to really be empowered and understand what's happening around you. So I would really urge people to understand what it means on top of what you meant, that it can be really a poison gift from a tax implication if you don't understand what you're doing. So you'd really want to understand and read twice what you're getting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also do some research, whether you're getting stock or not, but try to find out, like, how is this company funded? Are they depending on external cash? Did they do down rounds in the last couple of years? Or like these kind of questions, they tell you a lot of things about the company and how it's doing. And that's something I would want to know from a company who's paying my paycheck.
Yeah. And especially if you want to be a strategic kind of person, you want to understand what is the overall strategy around this company. We mentioned, I think, at the beginning that product is sexy also perhaps because it's part of the core of those new companies, and companies appreciate that product is important, it's material to their business. So this means that you as a product person have to understand how this company is making money. I was surprised about how many people you speak with and you figure out they don't even know how much money the company is making in the first place. You know, how their P&L, how their profit and loss table is looking.
Don't get me started on this topic. I mean, one of the skills that I think is totally underdeveloped, and I've seen that in the last 5 years constantly, is the part around viability and being literate in finance. I see a lot of PMs getting better and better at discovery, which is awesome because we didn't used to talk to customers firsthand or didn't understand the real needs in the market and so on. That's cool. But I think a lot of PMs are still shying away from the viability part of the product, as we said before, and I think that's something that makes a difference if you get used to that. And I'm not a finance person at all. Like, I studied comparative literature. It took me a lot of energy to get into that area. I had to learn it when I founded the first companies. But I think you need to have a minimum understanding of how unit economics work, how certain KPIs are built and calculated. A lot of people don't even know exactly the difference between profit and revenue. And I'm often really shocked. Right. So you need to know what the decision currency in your company is at any given point in time. And sometimes it's revenue, but it can also shift to cash flow. It can also shift to other things. Right. And you need to know before that happens, because that will influence a lot what is going to happen with the C-level. Right. If you know that your company is low on cash, you can already predict that the CEO is going to stand in your room and ask for a roadmap for the next board meeting and ask for like certain features that the investors want and so on. You can't predict that happen because you know that the company is operating and depending on the external cash flow, and they are willing to do whatever it takes just to stay alive.
Totally. And that's why I also think it's very important for people to understand what is the difference. What are you optimizing against? So of course, and we said at the beginning, we said, okay, company wants to make more money, like a high level general and KPI. But the reality, as you said, are you cash rich in this moment? Do you want to get more money in terms of, do you want to get more profits? Or do you want to make more cash in the short term, which is not the same thing? And again, understanding, I think, the overall context, and it requires a little bit of financial ability, but not too much either. I think as a product person, you can't shy away of this. You can't say it's not my business. You can say this is the business for my CFO or my accounting team.
No, and I think it's actually good to seek that kind of conversations. It's kind of the shared language that you have. And I think it's Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, who said that the limits of your language are the limits of your world. And if you're not able to speak finance, so to say, it's going to limit who you can interact with, because that's the shared language you have with certain people, right? And so I think a minimum of economic education is really good, also for your personal life, right? I really encourage a lot of people to start investing also with minor amounts of money, but just to get a feeling for how this works. And I'm not a professional at all in this, and I make a lot of mistakes, but I think just exposing yourself to this kind of thinking is really interesting and important in life.
You're opening another subject, which is very interesting. So we said at the beginning that we want to reduce this breach, right, before, let's say, between management or C-suite and product people. And as product person, you're thought that you have to speak the language of your customer. You want to try to do what you're doing and put in the perspective of the others. But in reality, when you talk into top management of your company, their language is going to be their P&L statement, is going to be their profit sheet and so on. So you want to understand this language if you want to speak their language. To a certain extent, I also have got the impression that as product person, we became a little bit too picky and we expected everybody to understand the language of product and everybody to understand what discovery means, everybody to understand what agile means, but we not the other way around.
Yeah, so I mean, since I studied comparative literature, I'm very obsessed with language, and everybody who has taken a course with me knows that, because I'm always trying to first get to a common definition of certain terms that we're using. So yeah, just as an example of one of the most used and misunderstood terms, that's outcomes, for example. A lot of companies saying, and also a lot of leaders approach us at the academy, say like, we want to our people to be more outcome focused, outcome driven, outcome based, whatever you call it, and please train them, right? And then I sit down with the leadership and ask them like, yeah, sure, I mean, we can train them on being more outcome driven or outcome based, but what is an outcome? Please give me an example. And then you realize like these five leaders in the room, they don't have a shared definition of what an outcome is. And most of the things that they have in mind are actually impact metrics or output metrics and or output things, right? And so outcome is always tied to user behavior. That's the only thing that we can actually influence, right? And so I think having these common definitions is so important. If you don't have a shared language, it's going to be very hard to create momentum in your company. But I lost track of your original.
No, totally. That's what I was trying to say. You said in a much better way than I did, but that's exactly what I tried to say. And I think to a certain extent, we can put the blame on others, you know, and back to this empowerment, we can put the blame on others. We can say we're not empowered as a team. We can say our management is short-sighted and they're just giving us output. That's true. But it also means that as a product person, you are supposed to do the extra mile and to try to get this empowerment and to try to speak their language.
Yeah, and I'm a huge fan of hypothesis-driven work. Mm-hmm. I think that's the basic thing that everybody needs to be able to master in product. And hypothesis in this context means there is an assumed correlation between the outcomes we're trying to achieve, so the change in behavior of the customers, and the impact that we're trying to achieve on the business side. So we need to be very clear on our hypotheses and assumptions around why do we want people to behave a certain way? What kind of metrics are supposed to change based on that, right? That's one thing. And the other thing is what I think does not happen often enough is to talk about guardrail metrics or health metrics. So often companies obsess about the metrics they want to improve or change for the better in general. But they are not very explicit about like under which circumstances. So we can drive top line revenue, no problem, right? But we can drive it at the cost of, for example, losing our loyal customers because we focus a lot on new customers and acquiring new markets and so on, right? So also thinking about like under which circumstances should this happen? What price are we willing to pay to achieve this goal? Those are questions that I try to teach people in our classes to ask, because those are the really important conversations around goal setting.
And I also love hypothesis-driven reasoning for probably a slightly different reason, which is it forces you to understand and to agree on what you meant in the first place. You're mentioning about do we understand the same about outcomes? If you're going through hypothesis-driven reasoning, it forces you to understand and to agree on what you wanted to reach in the first place. If you say, we want to increase our revenue. Everybody's going to agree on this, right? But you don't, you're not sure you're seeing the same. If you go through the full train of a hypothesis, eventually you will see if you don't land on the same thing at the end. So I think it is extremely, yes, extremely important.
And what you're touching on is not just definitions, but also general mental models that we operate within, and making those explicit, making the underlying assumptions explicit. And the more you do that, first of all, the faster you will be at writing your hypothesis. It still takes time to write a good hypothesis, but the first ones that you really draft in a good way, this takes forever, because you need to lay the foundation for everything else to come, right? The more you do that, the easier it will get. And also the harder it will get, because you will also start to spot all the fake correlations and all the proxy metrics that don't work, right? So it's getting harder and easier at the same time. And I think what is also a beautiful side effect is that, for example, when you onboard new people into your team and you have what I call a hypothesis backlog, which is one of the things that I try to also motivate people to have besides their feature backlogs, a backlog of questions, a backlog of assumptions and hypotheses that they want to test. When you have that and you keep track of what you think you found out in your discovery, which ones you need to retest after a while and so on, people can be onboarded much faster. You don't do the same work twice. And also you set the tone on how you work in this company, right? So it has a lot of beneficial effects to do that.
And if you look at this, like the fil rouge, the common story of everything we spoke about today is context, right? You want to be empowered with context. You want to talk about KPI or about outcomes, but with the context of what they mean. So what is around, and what you said, documentation about this context is probably extremely important to bring people on board. And also when you spoke about salary, it's not about the salary, it is the compensation with its whole context. How many hours you're working, or is it going in the direction of your future training, your future job?
I agree. And why is context important? I would take it even one step further. For me, everything revolves around decisions. Everything is about taking better and more educated decisions, because that is our output as product people. We don't build the product ourselves. Our output are decisions, and our job is to get better at taking decisions, whether it's about our personal career, like whether to stay or to leave, what kind of salary to negotiate for and so on, but also in our product, like what are the next things that we're going to build, and what is the market that we're going to enter. Decisions are what moves a company forward, and the better and faster you can take your decisions, and the more you reflect on these decisions to get better, the better you get at your core job. And that's why I think, like, I'm very obsessed with the topic of learning organizations. And for me, learning organizations are very decision-centric organizations. And that is tied to the roles, that is tied to the processes and so on. And I see a lot of work that still needs to happen in many organizations to get to that level.
And about decisions, I think we can dedicate a full episode of a podcast to decisions.
You can ask the next guest.
It's a topic I love. And as you said, unfortunately, I see it like very difficult for some PMs and people in general to take decisions. Part perhaps is what you're mentioning at the beginning, moonshots or very difficult, very ambitious goals to get. I think there is probably still a fear in trying to achieve them. But decision is also the ingredient you need to be able to do your job effectively as a PM. As you correctly said, Tanya, I think is everything we're asking you is to take decisions. So,
Yeah.
Tanya, thank you very, very much. It was extremely interesting. And like always, I don't usually know what we're going to talk about. I knew it was going to be interesting. And if I had to find a title for this episode, it's going to be Context from My Perspective. I really think you added a lot of context from different perspectives to how become empowered, how to get your right compensation, how to get decision pushed, and what outcome-based means for you, again, with this notion of context. Talking about context, where do people find you and how can they reach out to you?
Yeah, I love when people reach out. It's always good to know what resonated and which questions may not have been answered. So definitely you can find me on LinkedIn. I make it a policy to always reply to all reasonable requests on LinkedIn, not the super unsolicited marketing ones, but everybody who writes me will get an answer sooner or later. It might take a couple of days because I only work part-time because of the kids, but I will get back to you. I also have a personal website. So those of you who want to get to know me on a a personal level, I do write a very personal newsletter. You can find some editions from the past on my personal website, tanyalaw.com, and then obviously productacademy.ch, where you can find our courses. And you can definitely reach out if you don't know whether one of those courses is the right one for you. Probably I will not be the one answering this question for you, but I will redirect you to one of our alumni, because I love for them to share their own experience. I don't want to sell you anything. I think it's very important for us to have the right people in class, and those are the ones who really found the right level of course at the right moment in time. Those are the people we're looking for. So if we can help you make that decision for you, talking about decision, we're happy to give you more context. And it was really awesome talking to you, Sala.
No, thank you very much, Tanya. And all these addresses you mentioned are going to be in the description of this episode. So for don't worry if you didn't hear or you didn't have the time to know them now, they're going to have a clickable link anyway in the episode. Tanya, thanks again and talk to you soon.
Yeah, same here. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.